From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A deal by the end of this day. That's what President Biden says he wants. And Republican negotiators are meeting with him today to try to move closer to an agreement on an infrastructure bill. But they've been at this for weeks. And here's what Democratic Senator Ben Cardin, chair of the Senate Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee, told Morning Edition today.
No, I don't think we'll see a deal today, but I think the discussions are ongoing. We're going to continue to negotiate and do as much as we can on a bipartisan basis.
Yeah. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell is here. So, Kelsey, it is deadline day, but we just heard, I don't think we'll see a deal today. Where are we?
Well, this deadline was kind of set by Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg in kind of an informal way. It has never really been completely embraced by the administration, in part because deadlines in Washington are often really soft when they're in the process of trying to get a deal on something this big. There is value in saying that they want to get something done by a certain time because it forces people into a room, it forces people to talk, and it forces people to act seriously. But we're in a situation where, as Senator Cardin noted, there's a lot of work to be done. They are hundreds of billions of dollars apart in terms of the scope. Democrats are talking about the scale of about $1.7 trillion. Republicans have moved around the $1 trillion mark. That is a huge gulf. There are also major differences on how to pay for this. And while that may seem like a second step once they've already agreed on what they're going to do, how you pay for a bill in Washington is almost always as important, if not more important, than getting to the deal on what you're going to do, because it tells you how much money you have to work with. And oftentimes, Congress will work backwards from there.
Yeah, well, we know Senator Shelley Moore Capito is leading the Republican efforts on this bill, meeting with the president today. Any more you want to tell us about how maybe in the last couple of days there have been some shifts, there's been some movement?
Yeah, so earlier in these conversations, we know the Capito has met with Biden several times. And last week kind of went into a situation where they were talking. The White House was talking about raising corporate taxes. They stepped away from that and said, well, how about a minimum tax of 15% on corporations to help pay for this? Republicans responded by increasing their offer of $928 billion by about $50 billion. But the White House sent out a press release on Friday in response to that, where they essentially said they appreciated her offer, but it wasn't far enough. So there is quite a bit of work to do, despite the fact that they are genuinely trading ideas and trading offers. Again, still hundreds of billions of dollars apart.
Right. And the president still has to contend with his own party. Bernie Sanders, other progressives don't want a watered-down bill. How is Biden negotiating with them?
That has been really interesting to watch, because what we're hearing and seeing is mostly these conversations with Capito. We do know that Congressman Peter DeFazio, who runs the Transportation Committee in the House, did also speak with Biden last week. And DeFazio is one of those people who is really pushing for a more holistic, a larger bill that looks much more like what Biden has proposed. And that means including provisions for preventing further climate change, addressing the green economy. He also wants to ensure that child care provisions are included in this bill, and elder care provisions, which are quickly becoming part of the core definition of infrastructure, not just for progressives, but for a lot of Democrats who say they signed on to Biden's plan because they wanted to do something big and transformational for the economy. They see this as further growth out of, you know, the efforts that they made to address the economy during the pandemic. They say they want to build on that and grow jobs and grow, you know, the economy through further government spending.
Well, there are Democrats, and then there's West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. He's blocking legislation that lacks Republican support. He defended his opposition to a federal voting rights bill Democrats have backed in an op-ed yesterday. That's enraging some fellow Democrats. Here's what Democratic Representative Jamal Bowman told CNN this morning.
Manchin is not pushing us closer to bipartisanship. He is doing the work of the Republican Party by being an obstructionist, just like they've been since the beginning of Biden's presidency.
You know, Kelsey, we're hearing anecdotally some Democratic voters saying the same thing. What's going on with this guy? But he does wield enormous power. So just how important is he to these infrastructure talks?
Well, Manchin has power in Washington that I think it goes in a couple of different directions. One thing is that he can genuinely prevent Democrats from moving forward on things because they need to have unanimous support in the Senate. The other thing he does, though, is he provides a lot of cover for some Democrats who may agree with him, who, you know, may not quite be ready to go forward with $1.7 trillion in spending, who may not be ready to sign on and vote for increasing taxes, people who maybe don't want to say that publicly, and then they don't have to because Joe Manchin is the one who's willing to go out there and be the one-man wrecking crew for Joe Biden's plans. So he has power, but he also has value for some Democrats who may agree with him, but, you know, have their own political reasons for not saying so publicly.
He also vowed yesterday he'd never vote to weaken or eliminate the filibuster. He says it means when Republicans are back in power, that'll be to their advantage, you know, to more easily pass legislation. But in the 30 seconds we have, are we going to see Democrats just ditch Republicans here?
It's so hard to tell in this moment. I think there is tremendous pressure from Democrats, from Biden, to move on. It will be a question of whether or not he feels like he can make any progress that could win enough votes in both the House and the Senate for a bill to become law.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Unemployed workers in four states will lose their extra $300 pandemic jobless benefit this week. Mississippi, Alaska, Iowa, and Missouri are the first of 25 states that will phase out the extra payments between now and mid-July. Supporters of ending the extra benefit early say they're trying to encourage Americans to get back into the workforce at a time when businesses can't find workers to fill open jobs. But could you call what's happening a labor shortage? Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS Business News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
And what do you think? You've been writing about this. Is it a true labor shortage?
It's hard to call it a labor shortage when we have millions of people who are about to be queued up to re-enter the labor force in the next few months. So I think there are a bunch of reasons that have contributed to some of the squeeze that's happening right now. The Fed tells us that about 20% of folks who are not working or working less are doing so for a simple reason. I have no one to take care of my kids, or I've had kids who are sort of doing the hybrid schooling method, and someone's got to be home. Some folks say, I got to take care of my aging parents who are around. I am at risk. So a lot of this has to do with a little bit of the end of the pandemic era, and I think that that's incredibly important. There are also folks who said, hey, you know what? I'm going to take the summer off, and I'll get back into the labor market after. All these people are coming out of the labor force at the same time. They're going to enter in slowly but surely. So I'm not sure we're actually at a shortage. Plenty of people could work. It's a question of what will induce them to get them back on the job.
I see. And just to stress your point a little further here, do you think things are going to get much better, say, in the fall when schools pick back up and many of them or all of them should be back in person?
Absolutely. And I also think that there's something real that happened during the pandemic that we should be aware of. And that is that, you know, there are a lot of people who were completely burnt out. They were frontline workers. They were people really highly impacted by this, either for health reasons or financially. They have taken this time to settle themselves and to try to figure out what comes next. I've heard from a ton of people from my podcast who've said, I'm not ready to retire, but I can't keep doing what I was doing. And obviously, the fact that there is an unemployment system with an extra federal benefit has surely assisted them because they could take the time, because they had money coming in, to figure out what does come next.
But now many of them will not have that $300 benefit, which was a big help to them. How do you think it would affect individual families and then also the broader economy?
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, we've had a number of states of use, as you said, you know, there's more than two dozen that are actually opting out of that federal program that provides $300 per week until September 6th. So on one hand, I think, okay, I understand it. You don't want to necessarily have someone be out of the labor force when they could be in. That seems like a rational idea. But on the other hand, you're right. This has been a lifeline to a lot of people. It has allowed them to actually think about what is the best place for them to go next. It's also been really important to states themselves that these folks who have the money coming in, they're spending money in their local economies. I think it's a bit short-sighted for a state to say, hey, we're out of this benefit plan. They may actually end up getting fewer tax dollars in as a result of that decision.
Do you think when people start getting back into the workforce, they're going to have a lot more leverage than they did before the pandemic to get higher wages, for instance, because people are so hungry for workers?
Absolutely. And right now, we are already seeing wages start to tick up by 2% from a year ago, and it's going to accelerate. Fascinating here is that, you know, we've heard a lot of folks say, oh, you know, there's no one out there and this is a problem. And, you know, in classic economics, what you would say is, well, if you can't get workers, then just pay them more. I think there's going to be a combination of higher wages, but I also think that would-be workers are going to have the opportunity to actually say, wait a minute, I don't want to just take this job for the money. I want benefits. I want hours that are a little bit either more flexible or at least in advance that make me able to plan my life. I think that workers are going to find themselves happily with a little bit more power in this classic relationship.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS Business News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thank you as always.
Take care.
We all know about the Salem witch trials of the 1600s in Puritan New England, when as many as 200 were tried for witchcraft. 19, mostly women, were hung. But what we didn't know is how many people today claim those victims as ancestors, particularly 71-year-old Rebecca Nurse, the oldest. She was at the heart of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. Her home is a museum in Danvers, Massachusetts. And when the Rebecca Nurse Homestead recently invited people to send cards for her 400th birthday, they were stunned at how many came, mostly from her descendants. We'll hear from one in a minute. But first, Catherine Rutkowski, curator and president of the Rebecca Nurse Homestead. Catherine, historians say witch trials were to keep women in line. But in Salem, the young women who claimed others had cast a spell on them, they felt very ill. They had seizures. Some today speculate it might have been a virus. Do we know what really happened?
No, and we get that question all the time, and it's so hard to pinpoint one answer. And I think it was what a lot of historians will say, the perfect storm. There was a lot of stuff going on. There were Native American attacks up north. They had had a particularly harsh winter. And the entire Puritan mindset at the time was when things happened, or good or bad, it was because you were being punished or rewarded by God. It's very interesting to look at the mindset of the Puritans, because I think as modern people, we really want to villainize them and make them into these bad people, but they were people reacting to a very real threat in their village. They're already in a negative state of all this bad stuff happening, and, well, who's to blame? But maybe someone in our own village is doing this. They're a very strict religious group that believes so much. Their entire life, their goal is to go to heaven. And when you're threatened with that by the thought of witches, which were like terrorists of the 1690s, they're the one thing that's going to keep you from going to heaven, that it's scary for them. And it seems silly today, because what we know about modern day witches and Wiccans is that it's a very nature-based religion, and it's nothing really dark or evil. And I think people confuse the two and think, well, maybe these women were doing these nature-based things. And it's like, no, they were being accused of signing their soul to the devil and wreaking havoc in their religious community.
What is the homestead like? It's the only home, by the way, of someone executed during the Salem witch trials that's open to the public. Are people curious?
We have really two distinct groups of people that come. We have people fascinated with the story of the witch trials. And our other group of people are descendants of Rebecca Nurse that come from all over the country, and sometimes outside the country, to visit their ancestors' home. I started working at the homestead at 14, and it always surprised me to see descendants, because I myself am not a descendant of anyone from the colonial era. So it was always interesting to me to see all these people that were relatives. And now it's so much more because of people doing ancestry and able to trace their roots back, that majority of the people that come in day to day are ancestors, and even sometimes find out that the same people visiting are from the same line and they're cousins, which is kind of interesting as well.
Wow. Tick off some of the names of celebrities who realize that they're descendants.
Yeah, so we found out, you know, not too long ago, Mitt Romney is related. We have Zach Braff from Scrubs. And Lucille Ball was related to the family as well.
I love that. I just love that Lucille Ball might have been related to this wonderful woman. I mean, you know, these are sort of almost Grimm's fairy tales, but these were real women and one man who were mm-hmm. executed. What was she really like?
We can gauge based on her court documents, and a lot of her records still survive today. And we can just tell a lot about how, even when she's first accused, she doesn't really get upset. She sort of like looks inward and does this sort of prayer and like talks to God and says, like, what have I done in my life that I should be accused of something like this? She doesn't turn around and say, oh, they're lying. Oh, they're this. It's what has happened. And she even offers to pray for the afflicted girls to hope that maybe whatever is afflicting them will pass. She was just very gracious about the whole thing and very accepting of what was about to happen, knowing that very much she would be executed very likely.
Oh, boy. Well, Arthur Miller and others saw it as a cautionary tale for today, right? About, you know, yes. intolerance and too strict a religious code that sort of converted into fear of people around you. Catherine Rutkowski, curator and president of the Rebecca Nurse Homestead in Danvers, Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, let's bring in now Beth Lambright from Corvallis, Oregon, one of the many descendants of Rebecca Nurse. Beth, how did you even know this?
My father had a funny first name. And I said, where'd you get this funny name? And he said, I don't know. And I said, Dad, I'm going to find that out before anything happens to you. And I did. His first name was Wilds. And Sarah Wilds was hung with Rebecca Nurse on the same day. And that's where it came from.
Wow. And how are you related to Rebecca Nurse?
She is my eighth great aunt. I'm actually directly related to her brother, Jacob. In fact, I'm related to six of the people that were executed.
Oh, my goodness. That's pretty chilling to think about that.
It's really chilling to think about that. And when I discovered the first one, I had to sit and pause for a few minutes and think. When I saw a death date, 1692 in Salem, the first thing I had in my throat was fear. I thought, uh-oh, somebody died in the Salem witchcraft. And somebody else was on the jury I was related to who was, you know, making these sentences on the other relatives.
Yeah, these are in the witchcraft trials.
Yes.
And there she is sentenced. She was also the oldest. Did you read Arthur Miller's The Crucible?
I not only read it, my daughter actually was in it in high school playing one of the accusing girls named Susanna Sheldon. And that was a gripping moment for me sitting in the audience watching my child acting out, accusing her ancestors.
Wow. Wow. And your thoughts about that this woman in particular was accused because yeah. in The Crucible, you know, it's set up that maybe her husband had some friction with the Puritans. There
exactly.
are many of our ancestors, but they were kind of wacky. And that
right.
may have been why, because she had such high moral character.
She had high moral character. She'd lived an exemplary life. She lived in a town as a farmer's wife, raised eight children right there on the farm. When I think about how her life was actually not anything we would have written a book about until she was 71. And here she is, 71, and I'm 70, so I can really relate to this now. She's bedridden. She's deaf. She hasn't done anything wrong. 39 of her neighbors are going to rise up and sign a form saying, don't accuse her. She's perfectly innocent. And the courts are going to end up ignoring it.
Yeah. Well, Miller portrays her as saintly and mm-hmm. kind of morally superior to everyone. Gentleness exudes from her. Page 24. Mm-hmm.
Yes. She said she was as innocent as a newborn child when they accused her. Certainly, she was a person who did some wrong things in her lifetime, but nothing that merits what she went through. In fact, she probably had better behavior most of the time than the village, for sure.
Right. And there she walks, head held high, you know, to the gallows. So what's it like to find out that there are so many others like you who have been so touched by her life?
You know, I'm so grateful to the Homestead organization because we actually got to visit there a few years ago. And standing in the great room there of her house, standing there in that room and realizing everything here around me looks pretty ordinary, spinning wheel, fireplace, and yet this ordinary life became an extraordinary moment of really heroism, saying, I won't admit I'm a witch just to live. I'm going to tell the truth. I didn't do anything wrong. And standing in the truth, she paid for that with her life. And she's one of my heroes. And to find other relatives through the organization is really fun. But it's even more important for my kids to see that some of the people in our family had tough times in their lives where they actually had to make a stand. And that can happen to us.
Well, I wondered if, you know, it's been kind of a crazy time here in the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of conspiracy theorists. I'm just wondering if you find yourself using it as a lesson because of what's going on right now.
Actually, it's funny you say that because I have used that as a lesson that no matter what your community might say about you, if you do not believe it's true, you stand in what you know to be true. And if your church members say that you're not what you think you are, you examine your heart and you stand in what you know to be true. You know, there's a second person buried at the Homestead property besides Rebecca Nurse. George Burroughs Sr. is buried there too. And he's one of our great grandfathers. And when he was examined, he said, well, burn me or hang me, I stand in the truth of Christ. That's a powerful thing to stand at his gravesite and know that he too had to make the same stand Rebecca did.
Well, I'm thinking that he said this and Rebecca Nurse said this, even as an angry mob, you know, pitchforks. I mean, we're seeing angry mobs today.
You know, and I thought about that too. We're seeing loud voices. They might look like the majority for a while, but it doesn't mean that they're always speaking truth. We have to be really careful, you know, that we understand who we are and what our truth is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's fascinating. Bethlehem Bright, one of many descendants of Rebecca Nurse, the oldest person executed during the Salem witch trials in 1692, written about, can't recommend it enough in Arthur Miller's The Crucible. This year, the 400th anniversary of her birth. Beth, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. This was delightful to visit with you.
Well, this was one of those I never thought we were going there stories. So Rebecca Nurse hung in 1692, a role model to descendants, and a cautionary tale today about mobs with modern-day pitchforks. If you want to send a birthday card, they're displaying them at the Nurse Homestead. We have a link at hereandnow.org.
What happens to police officers who get caught stealing, lying, or tampering with evidence? Each week, we open up an internal affairs investigation that used to be secret to find out how well the police police themselves. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Google will pay a nearly $270 million fine after regulators in France said the company gave an unfair advantage to its own digital ad business. Tech companies are facing a wave of antitrust investigations in Europe and here in the U.S. Google, we should say, provides financial support to NPR. The BBC's Theo Leggett joins us now. And Theo, what exactly did these French regulators say Google did to deserve the fine?
Well, the headline is that they say Google abused its dominant position in the market for internet advertising. But what they're actually supposed to have done is a little more complicated. In the old days, pre-internet, advertising was pretty simple. So a newspaper or magazine would sell space on its pages directly to advertising clients or their agents. The price paid would depend whether it was on the front page or page 7. A deal would be done between the sales guy and the ad buyer. And then I'm guessing everyone would head off for lunch. These days we have the internet and everybody has software to do those jobs for them. So a publisher will have software that's designed to get the best price for advertising space, and a buyer will have software to make sure that they get the most targeted advertising that hits the people who are most likely to be buying the product. And all of this goes through advertising exchanges. It all happens in automated fashion. It's like an automated auction. And in theory, everybody gets the best price. What Google is accused of having done by the French authorities is effectively to have rigged the market by having its various advertising technology tools favor each other. So, for example, Ad Manager, which is used by publishers to sell space, is linked up with an advertising exchange called ADX. And Ad Manager was providing ADX with data that was not available to people buying and selling advertising using different exchanges. So it's this preferential treatment of data, which Google is accused of. And as a result, it's had to reach a settlement with the French authorities, which has involved payment of this fine and commitments to be more fair, more equitable with the way it distributes data in future.
Right, so it's not just the fine. Google has also agreed to change its business practices and actually promise to let other companies use those tools that you're talking about. What
absolutely.
Can you tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely. And to make sure that the provision of data does not favor people using Google products. And what's interesting here is that this is a settlement. What we've got here is Google clearly working with the French competition authorities, partly, I'm sure, in order to minimize the financial consequences, but also to change its way of doing business so it doesn't get into trouble for it. And that is something that has been less common over the years.
We should say that fine is just a tiny fraction of the company's revenue. But what do you think this settlement means for all those other cases that are pending in Europe, but also in the United States?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. This is a small fine. You know, Google is a company that made an operating profit north of $40 billion last year, so $270 million isn't going to make a big hole in their accounts. Nevertheless, it does suggest perhaps a change in mentality. You know, Google did not contest the charges. It said, okay, here are our commitments to change things in future. And if it's willing to do that in France, then you can extrapolate and say it may well be willing to change the way it does business elsewhere in the world as well. But this is speculation. You know, what we have here is one competition authority settling one particular dispute. And as you say, there's all sorts of disputes out there between tech companies in the United States and European competition authorities. But this does seem, on the surface at least, to be a little bit more consensual.
The BBC's Theo Leggett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are lots of things we do not know about the virus that causes COVID-19. And one of the most fundamental questions that scientists don't have an answer to is, where did it come from? For more than a year, many dismissed the idea that the virus leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which houses China's first biosafety level 4 lab, one of the most secure of its kind in the world, where the deadliest viruses are studied with extreme care. But now, the Biden administration is investigating that possibility. Here's White House COVID advisor Andy Slavitt.
We need to get to the bottom of this, and we need a completely transparent process from China. We need the WHO to assist in that matter. We don't feel like we have that now. We need to get to the bottom of this, whatever the answer may be.
We are going to take a few minutes now to dig into how opinions have shifted. Betsy McKay is senior writer covering public health for the Wall Street Journal. Betsy, welcome.
It's nice to be here with you, Peter.
And we're going to get to the lab theory in just a moment, but is it fair to say that the prevailing theory still at this point is that the virus started in nature and then spilled over from animals to humans?
Yeah, that is the, I mean, there's a problem of a lack of evidence on both sides, but the belief is that the chances of that having happened and that being the source of the pandemic are greater. That's how Ebola started. Zika that swept the world, and many other viruses. And certainly the past two coronaviruses have spilled over from animals. This is the third one. And, you know, the prevailing view is that there was a similar type of spillover.
Okay. Well, that said, there still is this new scrutiny on the idea that it leaked from a lab. And if we are to entertain that theory, where does that story begin?
There was an obvious question from the very beginning. Why was the first outbreak of this brand new virus in Wuhan, in central China, when viruses of this sort, these SARS-like coronaviruses, have been found mostly in southern China? And then the second thing was, here's this world-class laboratory right in Wuhan studying these viruses. So it's kind of an obvious question to ask yourself, including the researchers at that institute, could it have come from there?
And there is this piece of information that we have learned recently that three researchers at that lab in Wuhan became sick in the fall of 2019. They had symptoms that might have been COVID-19. It maybe could have been the flu. I mean, what role did that play in sort of, you know, sparking people's suspicions?
Well, I think there have been several things over the past 2 or 3 months that have kind of revived interest in the possibility of a laboratory spillover, or at least in the desire to rule it out. This is from some intelligence reporting. It's not clear who the people were and what illness they had. I mean, you know, the flu was going around at the time, and so there's a lot that still needs to be learned about that. But it was one of the data points that, you know, led people to call for more investigation of the lab hypothesis.
There's something else I want to ask you about. It's called gain of function research, and that has gotten a lot of scrutiny as well in recent weeks because of this lab leak theory. What is that, and what role might it have played?
So gain of function research is a type of lab experiment in which you change a virus in some way to enhance it, to make it more transmissible or to be infectious to humans. And the Wuhan Institute of Virology has described doing experiments that seem to fit this definition. And the question actually is, though, did researchers have a virus at that laboratory that they were working with to make it more transmissible, and then that virus escaped from the lab in some fashion and started spreading among the population? The problems with that, one, is that the Institute says it did not have any viruses similar to the pandemic virus, and it certainly didn't have live viruses. You know, very often they have sequences, but not live viruses. So you would have to have a virus that was very close to the pandemic virus, like 99.999% similar, in order to do that. They say they didn't have it. So really, a lot of this lab hypothesis boils down to, do you believe what the Wuhan Institute of Virology is saying about the material and the viruses they had, or do you not believe them?
Have lab leaks happened before?
Yes. In fact, after SARS in 2003, there was a lab leak in Beijing. There were a couple others, and certainly there have been laboratory leaks throughout history. And, you know, there's regulation in the U.S. Even in the U.S., there are plenty of laboratory accidents. But one concern also is, what is regulation like around the world? What are the restrictions? They differ by country, yet high-security labs are growing around the world.
So that's the backdrop for all of this. Now, on January 30th of 2020, Republican Senator Tom Cotton spoke at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, compared the virus to Chernobyl, and then he said this.
I would note that Wuhan also has China's only biosafety level 4 super laboratory that works with the world's most deadly pathogens to include, yes, coronavirus.
As we know, President Trump would eventually pick up on this. It fit in with the approach that he took to COVID, which was to blame China. Can we just talk about that for a moment? If there was no clear evidence that the lab leak theory was false, why was it largely rejected by the scientific community and the media when people like Donald Trump started talking about it?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on. One is that scientists did look at the virus and analyze it and concluded themselves, you know, through genetic analyses and so forth, that was unlikely. The second thing is that this scientific question, you know, you go into something like this and you say, okay, where could this virus have originated from? And the laboratory would be one obvious place. But it was a scientific question that became highly politicized. And then that left scientists, some afraid to speak out, and it left others dismissing it as conspiracy theories. Because this was all wrapped up in blaming China, and making accusations that the lab had somehow concocted or engineered a virus, which really doesn't seem to have been possible.
Right. It could have just been a mistake. But was the Trump administration making those claims based off of the same intelligence that the Biden administration is now working off of?
So at the time, you know, the Trump administration was starting to collect information, but wasn't disclosing it. For months, they said, you know, various versions of there's evidence, we have evidence, and didn't provide any. So that also created a lot of suspicion. I mean, what's the evidence? And, you know, you can't make any judgments based on nothing, right? In January of this year, in the last days of the Trump administration, they did put out a fact sheet at the State Department listing a few things, one of which was that, you know, some employees of the Institute had been sick in the fall of 2019, sort of a broader, less specific version of what's come out recently. So the Biden administration has picked up with the same intelligence, hasn't outright denied or dismissed any of it, but also hasn't spoken out about it.
Well, considering the way that politics has muddied the picture here a little bit and the fact that Beijing is closed off and maybe not willing to be as public with the information as the world would like, what do you think the likelihood is that we'll ever know the true origin of this disease?
I think it's going to be a challenge because things have become so polarized. I mean, you know, any scientist on any side of this will tell you what you need is international collaboration. You need scientists working together. And that involves Chinese scientists who are able to work freely and a government that is willing to disclose information. Without that, you know, it's going to be probably impossible to rule out the laboratory. And at the same time, you need international collaboration to pursue the other hypothesis that it spilled over in nature. And so there are some big challenges ahead.
Betsy McKay, senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The U.S. housing market is crazy right now. How crazy? Well, Derek Thompson tells us one hopeful buyer in Bethesda, Maryland, promised to name her firstborn child after the seller. She did not get the house, maybe thankfully, depending on the seller's name. Home prices are at a record high. Inventory is at a record low. Homes are selling in the blink of an eye, way above what sellers are asking for. Are you worried that you better get in now, buy before it's all gone? Well, Derek talked to specialists who said, let's see what they said. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us every Monday. Derek, you say this hot market all comes down to supply and demand. Start with the demand. Explain that.
Yeah, there's four big reasons why demand is so high right now. The first is demographics. Millennials are the largest generation in American history. The average age of a millennial right now is about 30 to 31. That happens to be exactly the age at which historically we've expected people to buy first homes. Well, here they are storming the housing market. So that's number one. Number two, you got to mention the pandemic. I think a lot of people feel sort of pent up cabin fever. They're looking to leave their apartment, looking to leave their condo, or looking to leave their house. You have that pent-up urgency to get new digs. Three, to make things even wilder, homebuyers are flush with cash. The national savings rate spiked to its highest level in four decades last year, so people have a lot of money they are able to spend. And then finally, interest rates are low enough that that money can go a long way. So these low interest rates, I think, are luring more buyers into the market, encouraging higher bids. And then I think that, you know, the frenzy all happening at once, I think, is getting some people who might be on the sidelines thinking, oh my God, everyone's buying a house. Now I have to as well.
Okay, first of all, as a boomer, I am so disappointed we've been displaced by the millennials as the biggest age group. But then there's also supply. More older Americans are staying home, aging in place, not giving up their homes. But wow, the manufacturing backlogs, the high lumber prices, people aren't building.
Yeah, inventory is really at crisis levels. We're now in a market where inventory, the amount of houses that are available to buy, is the lowest on record, and certainly the lowest on record as a share of total buyers. So that's a huge problem. And then in addition to that, there are construction projects that have been put on hold because all of these because things like lumber have gotten so expensive. Lumber prices have tripled in the last 6 months. So I think there's a couple construction companies that would be building houses right now, but they're essentially saying we're going to wait for lumber prices to normalize before we continue with this project. That, again, that pause helps to constrain inventory. And so this combination of low supply, high demand means you have the weirdest and hottest, in a way, housing market in American history.
Okay, so there's the scene. And you spoke with economics writer and guru Bill McBride, who predicted the 2007 housing collapse. So first, what did he say about how long this current situation goes on?
Well, I think it's really important to be clear that Bill doesn't think we're in a bubble right now. He thinks that what's happening is being driven by fundamentals. The existence of the millennial demographic is a fundamental. The average age of the millennial demographic is a fundamental. The fact that people want to live in houses and own homes, that's a fundamental as well. So this isn't 2005, 2007, where smart people should expect that we're about to see this bubble burst. It's nothing like that. The problem is that inventory is low, and it's going to take a while for it to be replenished so that the number of houses that are available in any given market, whether it's Boston or Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles, is normal enough that housing prices aren't going so crazy and all these winning bids are coming massively over listing.
Yeah. And we should remind people, in the housing crash of 2007, you know, people were being sold homes they couldn't afford, and those bad mortgages were being, you know, then bought and sold. I mean, it was just a mess. It had no infrastructure. You're saying this does. I mean, these really are millennials who really are looking for homes, who really can, you know, put the money down, but there's just not enough homes. So, again, to answer that question for people who are saying, I got to get in now, there's not going to be anything left. What did Bill McBride say about getting into this?
Yeah, this is the last question I asked him. I said, you know, put yourself in the shoes of a couple that's in their 30s. They're looking to buy a home. They are feeling totally exhausted by the housing market because every time they bid, someone beats them by X thousand dollars. What do you do now? He said, I'd wait. Housing starts, that's the number of houses that are that work is, has begun on, has been over 1 million for 10 straight months. That's the longest stretch in 14 years. So inventory is being replenished. It's just going to take about a year, I think, for the zaniness to chill out. And next year, I think, will be a much more normal year when it comes to housing prices. You won't have the sort of scenarios where, as you mentioned at the top, people are offering to name their firstborn after the former owner of the house and still being turned down. That kind of zaniness, I think, I hope, is a 2021 phenomenon. 2022 will still be a good year for real estate. It just won't be completely nuts.
Others told you that they've never seen so many people migrate, move state to state to buy homes. And maybe when the pandemic calms down a little bit, people might not be doing that anymore. We'll take that up with you at another time. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, always illuminating. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.